It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. She's a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Let's talk about the housing market, the residential housing market, as they say. We understand that it's slowing a little bit. What's the word or what's life like in your neck of the woods?
You know, it's crazy out there. Certain price categories, let's say under $600,000, it's still a hot market. I'll give you an example. Just put an offer in on something. There's multiple offers on it. The number that we agreed on, I'm thinking this will never appraise. Let's just put the number in. We'll deal with the appraisal. You know, go figure, it appraises.
Wow.
I'm still scratching my head. Uh-huh. Then somebody else just told me about a property. He asked my opinion of value. They're asking like high sevens. I said, really shouldn't be listed more than $699. Mm-hmm. They got an offer well into the sevens.
Wow.
And the seller didn't take it, which is even crazier.
Yeah.
So the market, it's...
Sounds a little desperate.
There is. It comes down to, you know, we say it over and over again, lack of inventory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the inventory is starting to climb a little bit and depends on what price category you're in.
Yeah.
Anything over a million, it's a very much buyer's market. So it's all driven by price categories.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that if there's so little on the market in that price range, people are looking and looking and looking. Maybe they just go, you know, they do the math again and again and they go, okay, we can stretch this. We can afford it. The fact that the seller said no is also psychologically very interesting as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, housing prices are rising, as you've just mentioned, but statistically throughout the nation, they're rising.
They are still rising. They're not rising at the rate that they have been. We're starting to see a stabilization in the overall market.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the best way for me to describe it.
Yeah. Yet new construction, looking at the builder side of things, I mean, they have to pay more because construction costs are going up.
That's right.
There's a shortage of labor, so they have to pay more to get labor. What's going on, you know, in terms of new homes?
Well, they're still building them, and there's still a very strong demand for new construction. But like you just said, the cost is increasing, coupled with the rising interest rates, putting upward pressure on home prices and really contributing to the affordability of these homes.
Yeah, I want to get into the affordability thing. So there is a statistic that says that housing affordability is now at a 10-year low, which takes it back to the second quarter of 2008.
Right.
Right. So right now, 57% of new and existing homes were affordable to families earning the median income of $71,900. So that's 57%. That's down.
That's right.
How much is that down by?
Well, it was at 61.6%. So that this is actually the lowest reading since mid-2008.
Yeah. So really the bubble burst...
2006.
2006. So what was going on by 2008? It was still pretty bad.
It was still bad. It took a while. It was several years.
Yeah.
You know, that's where it started in 2006. And then it continued to go down and then, you know, slowly come back up.
Yeah. So that housing affordability led in some ways to the crash because it limited demand. Of course, back then they were giving a lot of loans that people should not have had,
right,
that they should not have given. I don't think they're doing that so much anymore. So you don't get the sense that the real estate market has overheated or anything like
that. No, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Though I find it very interesting that you thought a price was reasonable. They got an offer for
even
a
more.
Price or more, and they didn't take
and
that
And they didn't
offer.
Take it. I'm still scratching my head. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see the end of that story. I want to follow that one.
All right. So let's talk about the most affordable and least affordable places in the United States. Let's start with the most affordable.
It honestly, it's probably nowhere we want to move to. Sorry, nation.
Yeah,
but
don't say that. These are wonderful places.
They are wonderful places. They're just not warm.
They're
like
not
South Florida.
Yeah, they're not South Florida. You're spoiled.
Syracuse, New York.
Okay.
So you have to bring jackets,
yeah,
if you're going to move there.
Definitely cold up there.
Elmira, New York. Scranton, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Indianapolis, Indiana. Youngstown, Ohio.
Yeah, so a lot of them are in that New York and, you know,
yeah,
kind of the old industrial area. But here's what I found interesting, that in Syracuse, for example, 89% of all new and existing homes were affordable to families making $74,000.
Yep, and that's awesome news. That's good.
Yeah.
That's what you want to see. That's healthy.
In Elmira, New York, 97% of the homes were affordable to families earning $71,000. So obviously, but I think it's harder to make more money in those areas.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. So we're looking at 71,000.
Yeah.
That may be good here.
That's right.
And that's probably a lot of money there. So
yeah, exactly. All right. So that's not really addressed in these statistics. All right, let's go to the least affordable. The ones listed here are all in California.
Yes, starting with San Francisco.
We've heard about that, right?
Yeah, sure have.
5.5% of the homes sold are affordable to families, earning the area's median income, which is about $120,000.
Yeah, that's just sad. Really, really sad.
5%.
And then Los Angeles and San Jose, California.
Yeah, that's not surprised. All right, let's get to my real estate survival guide, one of my favorite segments. Here's a good question. My two sisters and I own a condominium unit together, and we each own 1/3 of it. The association is trying to force us to choose a primary owner, and we want to be treated equally. Can the board do this?
Well, when you have multiple owners, most governing documents require the owner to select a primary occupant. There's many reasons for it, but the first is to prevent a timeshare situation where you could theoretically have 52 owners of a condominium unit, and each of the 52 owners could claim it as a separate week ownership.
Yeah, so they want to avoid this idea
of the hotel,
the kind of transient situation. These are people's homes.
Right, and they do allow you to change the primary ownership a few times during the year, so that's a good thing that to avoid that timeshare.
So the answer is they probably can't do it, and there's good, solid reasons for it.
Right, right. It's possible to have 10 co-owners of a unit. The primary occupant mechanism reduces the overtaxation of the common elements. There's lots of reasons you want to have. Just think about the voting rights.
Yeah. How do you get this?
You need to have
three people voting
right
on the four things aboard. You can't have that.
Right, exactly.
One person, one vote, one house, one vote, that type of thing.
Right.
My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams. She can be found at terrystory.com.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Thanks, Terry. And to hear this again, don't forget to go to our website where we really do invite your questions. And we also have a weekly update of all the things spoken here and talked about with the great Terry Story. Go to stevepomerantz.com.